from WBUR Boston, I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, Happy New Year!
That was a scene last night in Times Square. In Washington, it was a very different scene. Lawmakers and just about every journalist in town found him or herself rocking the night away with Harry Reid, Mitch McConnell, and Joe Biden. No party hats or bubbly for that crowd. Negotiations on the fiscal cliff deal went back and forth all night long, and then finally, they struck a deal. But it's not time to celebrate yet, as the House still needs to vote, and as we go to air, it is not. This hour, On Point, high-stakes drama at the Capitol is a deal in reach. Joining us now from Washington, where she's been working tirelessly all night, is Gail Chadwick, Washington politics editor at the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, Happy New Year, and thanks for joining us.
Hi, Bob. Thank you.
Also from Washington, we're joined by Lori Montgomery of the Washington Post, where she covers U.S. economic policy and the federal budget. Happy New Year to you, Lori, and thanks a lot.
Happy New Year, Bob.
You don't sound very happy, Lori. Gail, let's start with you. You were on Capitol Hill all night long until 4 a.m. Describe the scene, the mood up there before and after the Senate vote.
Well, my sense was that it was just constantly shifting back and forth. You know, people, the journalists were running around tracking rumors. You know, had this piece fallen out? Had this come in? Everyone you talked to didn't want to be there when the ball dropped in New York City. The cry in the press gallery was, Happy New Year, your taxes just went up. So I think you could say that the Capitol was not full of people eager to be there, but there was, I think, a very dramatic sense of progress when the vice president got involved in the talks over the weekend and when he appeared in the Senate. That was when that's when I had a sense that this actually was going through.
So how did the deal happen then? How did it get worked out?
Well, as you know, the negotiation had gone on for some time between the Speaker and the President. And when that fell apart, the initiative switched to the Senate. Didn't look promising. The Senate hasn't been able to pass a budget in 3 years. It is a model for legislative gridlock. And when talks between two very seasoned leaders, Mitch McConnell and Harry Reid, went silent Saturday night between 7 and about 1 in the afternoon. At that point, McConnell called in Joe Biden. Now, it's unusual now to think of the vice president playing a big legislative role, but in the 19th century, the vice president spent more time in the Senate than in the White House. And there, even now, Biden's salary is paid for by the Senate. So it's not out of historical range that he should have taken such a big role. But he's a negotiator. And he and McConnell just did what they had did before, you know, when there was a issue over extending the Bush tax cuts of late December 2010, and came up with a proposal which they then sold to their respective parties. Now, there's been a lot of writing about how hard it was to bring Republicans on board. But I think the real story here could be how hard it was to bring Democrats on board. And that, I think, is where Biden really shone.
Did Biden then, in a way, upstage President Obama, or was he at this work with a full understanding and support of the president? Was that his hammer?
Well, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Gail. You first and then Lori.
No, I spent most of the evening trying to figure that out. You know, you had a classic kind of tough cop, soft cop routine going. The president gave an extraordinary campaign-style event earlier on Sunday in which he just repeatedly went after Republicans, pointed out that they had given up on their principles on tax reform, that he was the president and he wasn't going to do this by spending cuts. And, I mean, it really was a kind of stick in the eye of House Republicans who are going to have to pass this. And a lot of us were wondering, well, gee, what's that about? But I didn't realize until later in the day how difficult it was going to be to get this by Democrats. Now, Tom Harkin took to the floor very early and said, who thinks that $450,000 is a middle-class income? It isn't. You know, this is wrong. And so the president's aggressiveness against House Republicans, and I think the appearance that, you know, this is a decisive victory over them, was designed for Democrats and not not Republicans as we initially thought.
Lori Montgomery from the Washington Post, your turn to weigh in.
Yeah, Biden has become the president's closer on these tough deals. I mean, he's been friends with Mitch McConnell for years and years, unlike Obama, who really spent almost no time in the Senate. He just zoomed right out of there into the White House. He doesn't have the same relationships that the vice president does, and that appeared to be the problem on Saturday night, Sunday morning, Friday, when McConnell was getting so frustrated with Reid, who, as Gail points out, was dragging his feet in part because Democrats didn't want to have their fingerprints on this deal. And it was one of the things that made yesterday so bizarre. It's like, you know, in the middle of the day when things should have been coming together and we should have been seeing a bill and we should have been seeing a budget score, nothing was happening. Harry Reid disappeared from the floor. Democratic leaders were nowhere to be found. Republicans were wandering around saying, we think we have a deal with Joe Biden. You know, I gave up and went to the liquor store and did indeed buy some champagne because it looked like we were going to be there all night.
You know, is the president was accused repeatedly during this debate, during the weeks of this debate, for not rolling up his sleeves and diving into it to doing the hard work of negotiating on the deal. He left that to Biden. So is he still subject to that criticism, you think?
The president?
Yes.
To the criticism that he did not, well, you know, he doesn't necessarily, I mean, this is what Biden is good at. And Obama has long faced criticism, probably deserved, that he does not have the relationships to manage this Congress. I mean, it's a particularly unmanageable Congress, no doubt about it. John Boehner is having his problems, and, you know, he's the putative leader of the House Republican Party. But, you know, they all complain, I mean, even some Democrats, particularly in the Senate, that they don't really have a relationship with the guy, which I think is why you keep seeing Joe Biden come in at all these tough moments. I mean, not just to seal the tax deal at the end of 2010, but he also came up for the debt limit. And, you know, he's sort of the guy the White House relies on to come in, as he did last night, meet with the Democrats, calm everybody down, answer all their questions, you know, which doesn't mean that they've succeeded. I mean, the Democrats are, in particular, in addition to the concession on the threshold, after promising to raise rates on people over $250,000, Obama gave all the way up to $450,000. There's a lot of fury in both the House and Senate Democratic caucuses about the terms of the estate tax, which is going to exempt just enormous estates.
Were you, in the end, when the vote came, surprised by the overwhelming margin by which it passed, only a handful of senators from both parties voting no?
I was surprised. I was watching the vote count, and I messaged my colleague who was in the chamber, oh my God, they're going to get 90 votes for this thing. And if there had been two people were absent, I think if they'd been there, they would have gotten 90 votes. And what it makes you wonder, it makes me wonder, after covering this ridiculous budget battle for 2 years now, we Republicans voted for the first time in 20 years last night to let taxes go up. And they did it fairly cheerfully. It sort of makes you wonder if maybe all of this angst is it truly is political positioning by the leaders, and if we just put some of this stuff on the floor, we could get it done.
Lori, you think? I mean, Gail, you think that's correct?
I do. Now, that one of the very striking things that came out of the last election for Republicans was, you know, realization that their popularity, you know, is the lowest of the low. They are not doing a good job selling this message, and some adjustments have to be made. And I think you're seeing that across the board. And that is going to be the issue when the House takes up this bill. It's going to be a very, very tough vote for that House Republican caucus.
Do you think we'll get to a debate and a vote today?
You know, I'm hearing a lot of mixed reports on that, certainly not until late in the day. What the Speaker said yesterday is that he will fulfill his promise to take the bill to the floor for vote. Now, to listeners, that may sound like a trivial point, but that's huge. That is the essence of gridlock, that neither the House nor the Senate will bring each other's bills up for a vote. Well, this one will see a vote, The key thing will be on what terms. In the House, there is a very powerful body called the Rules Committee that gets to decide the terms on which a bill is voted. What amendment is in order, for example? If the Rules Committee decides to allow in order an amendment that gives people a chance to vote to eliminate all tax increases, that is a poison pill point for this legislation. If, however, it's allowed as, little arcane here, what's called a motion to recommit, that could be a very different picture. It wouldn't be as destructive to the bill. And that's something leadership is sorting out right now. I haven't been able to get an answer to that this morning.
So from your point of view, we still may plunge over the fiscal cliff, or at least further over than we are right now.
I'll just say there'll be more drama about it. Remember, just a couple weeks ago, you had the Speaker take to his own caucus a bill that is much less generous than this one. It would have exempted estates $1 million and under, not 450. And he couldn't get support, enough support in his own caucus for that. And the vote count's interesting there, too, because initially we all reported that, you know, a couple dozen Republicans wouldn't support it. But the more work I do on this, the more people are popping up.
Gail Chadwick, we know you have to go. Washington editor for the Christian Science Monitor. More talk about what the House will do as we continue On Point. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're starting 2013 where 2012 ended. We're talking about the fiscal cliff and what lawmakers on Capitol Hill will do. We're talking with Lori Montgomery of the Washington Post this hour, and right now we'd like to bring another voice into the conversation. Joining us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. Hello, Jack, and thanks.
Hello, Bob.
Lori, let me start with you here, if I can. If the House, which is where we ended the last segment, if the House alters the Senate plan, where do you think that'll come?
Where would it come? Oh, my God, that's impossible to say. At this point, it's just a little hard to imagine that they would try to do that. And I don't think, I mean, I wouldn't put anything past this bunch because they are just so unpredictable. But I can't imagine that that would be their strategy. I think that they would be more likely to not bring it up or throw the bill that they've already passed on the floor. I guess if they wanted to amend this bill, they could. The primary thing they would probably try to adjust is the threshold. But I don't know where they would put it. I mean, they had a threshold of $1 million 2 weeks ago, and they couldn't get the votes for that. So this thing, if it's going to pass the House, it's got to pass with both Democratic and Republican votes. And if they mess with the bill too much, they're not going to get Democrats. Democrats, as I said before, are already a little irked about the threshold moving up from $250,000 for the income tax hikes and the terms for the estate tax. So, you know, they've got to make a decision here, and Boehner's got to man up and put this thing on the floor the way it is and get it done, or it's not going to get done.
Jack, your view, is the House likely to tinker with this, change it in any way?
Bob, I really don't know, but I'd just like to make three quick points about this Senate deal. You know, from the point of view of morality, it seems to me this is just a great gain. 2 million people would have lost their long-term unemployment benefits. And what does that mean? Well, a Boston Globe profile of a woman in Dorchester, a Boston neighborhood, 60 years old, laid off after 30 years as a daycare worker, has the care of her 3-year-old grandson. She gets $218 a week. How does she manage it on that unemployment benefit? I don't know. But she said that if she loses that, they might have to go to a shelter. She won't have to go to a shelter. Millions of Americans won't have to endure that penury. That's a great moral gain. Second, this agreement does very little economic harm. Even the raising of the threshold up to $450,000 is probably good for the economy, because the Congressional Budget Office estimated that keeping the limit at 200 250,000, which is what the president wanted to do, could have cost as much as 200,000 jobs. This cuts that in half, maybe 100,000 jobs. It allows the recovery to go on. And three, this agreement, the Republican agreement, all these senators to raise taxes on the most affluent, begins to reverse the politics of inequality, which has defined our political order now for a generation. This is a step to say the rich are going to pay more. That money is going to be used to partly to give tuition tax credits to families, to help with mobility and so on. That's just a great social good.
But in debating the package overnight and coming to agreement, the senators bypassed the big question, the sequester, the huge package of budget cuts. Did negotiators have to put those cuts off for 2 months as the only way to reach a deal on the tax cuts?
Jack, go ahead. Apparently they just couldn't. That was too much for them. The Democrats wanted them delayed for, I think, a year. Lori, isn't that right? And this was the Republican timetable.
Well, initially the White House wanted 2 years. I mean, the problem with sequestration is that neither party wants it really to hit, but Republicans are particularly concerned about the cuts to the Pentagon. So both parties really wanted to get that done. The fight was over whether or not you replace those cuts with some other kind of cuts, which is what the Republicans wanted. And Obama insisted that, take some of the tax revenue we're raising and offset it. So in the end, that's what they did. They only pushed it off for 2 months. But the reason they chose that timetable is in part because we're about to have another big fight over the debt limit, which we have to raise in the next 2 months. So why not just tack this onto that?
You mentioned, Lori, that in the Senate talks, the White House had sought the 2-year delay in dealing with a sequester. Looking ahead, how likely do you think that is to be the White House position down the road when this debate returns in 2 months?
Well, so that's a really good question, because what we're going to get back to is the question of whether or not it's possible to do a big deal. The sequester is a blunt instrument to cut $1.2 trillion from the Pentagon and other agencies over the next decade by evenly across the board just taking a whack at those budgets. It's an almost 10% cut for everybody. People are very upset about it. It's going to cause furloughs and layoffs and God only knows what. And the whole idea of the thing was to, create a situation that was so difficult that Congress would finally come together and adopt a very big, broad, rational plan for reducing the record deficits that we have that would raise taxes, and it would rein in spending on Social Security and Medicare, and it would make other changes, rein in farm subsidies, do things that everyone agrees there's fat in the budget and there are ways to pull this down. But instead, what we've got now is sort of a situation where we kicked the can down the road. We didn't really make very many changes. We did raise taxes on rich people a bit, but we didn't do any of the other stuff we were going to do. We've got this nasty fight over the debt limit coming up, and the appetite for the kind of sweeping tax reform, entitlement reform stuff that Boehner and Obama had been talking about, I think, is rapidly dissipating. So the question of whether we actually get to a point where we do replace the sequester is really an open question.
So you think that the coming fight over the sequester cuts and increasing the federal debt ceiling is going to be even more bruising than the battle we just went through to get to today?
I had a senior Democrat in the House tell me last night that he thinks that the next 6 weeks are going to be absolutely hellish compared with the last 6 weeks because, this is real. The fiscal cliff is one thing. I mean, you hear it's a slope. We've already gone over it. The world still exists. Maybe we would go into recession if they don't do something by the end of the week, but who knows? If we breach the debt limit and stop paying our bills, that is cataclysmic. And almost everyone agrees that that's a deadline that we cannot miss. And you've already got the president saying he's not going to negotiate over it and that they're going to want additional tax revenue, and Republicans saying, no, we're going to use the debt limit to get more spending cuts. So you've got the same clash, but we're coming up to a hard deadline that has the capacity to disable the world economy.
In terms of the sequester, would you say that there's no way the Republicans are going to go along with the White House position and delay it for 2 years, if in fact that continues to be the White House position?
Well, everybody would like to get rid of the sequester for 10 years, but the problem is that agreeing on a plan to replace it. And until this point, Republicans have insisted that the thing you replace the sequester with be spending cuts. And Obama has made very clear that he is not going to replace $1.2 trillion in spending cuts with new spending cuts. It's going to have to include tax revenue. So this is we're back to the fundamental question. What are we going to do to tame these rising debts? And are Republicans going to agree to raise additional tax revenue, or are they going to continue to insist, somewhat irrationally, I think, that we can, in fact, cut spending beyond what we've already scheduled?
Lori Montgomery, I know you have to go. Let me ask you one more question. Who, then, do you think holds the upper hand in that coming fight, the White House, congressional Democrats, or congressional Republicans?
Well, Republicans clearly believe that the ground now shifts once we get this cliff behind us, where taxes were going to go up on everybody no matter what, unless they did something, that we now enter a period where the leverage falls to them because the White House is the entity responsible for managing the nation's finances, and they are the guys who are going to get blamed if we default on their watch. So the White House desperately needs the debt limit to go up. But the White House is saying, we're not going to negotiate over the debt limit. We're not going to let you take us hostage again like you did in the summer of 2011. So, that's why I say it's just, the Republicans are going to have a lot more leverage. Democrats are insisting that they're not going to let them use it. And we're just in for, I think, a really painful time.
Lori Montgomery, who covers economic policy and the federal budget for The Washington Post. Thanks very much for joining us. We appreciate it after all your work overnight.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us now here on Point is John Harwood, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC and writer for The New York Times. Hi, John.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. So let me ask you the same question we closed with Lori with there. Who holds the upper hand right now in the coming fight over the sequester, the coming additional fight over the fiscal cliff and the raising the federal debt ceiling?
Honestly, I'm not sure anybody holds the upper hand. As I agree with what Lori just said, it's a mess. The Republican Party, if you look at polls, is on the short side of the argument. However, President Obama is responsible for governing the country. We did not solve with this deal that the Senate passed the issue of do we need more revenue or not. You know, that would have been a significant fact if, in fact, the deal was such that it said, okay, we've taken care of the revenue part of the equation, now we look at the spending cuts. We didn't settle even that question. We only got part of the revenue. And so the president yesterday in his event signaled, yes, I'm going to go for more revenue later. So how do you do that? And you have Republicans in this position, as Lori said, that's a bit irrational. It's a bit incoherent in the sense that they say we need a lot more spending cuts. Everybody knows the spending cuts they're talking about are spending cuts in the big entitlement programs, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. However, they are scared themselves of proposing those spending cuts. So it's a bit of a primal scream saying, do it, but I don't know how to do it, or I don't want to do it. And the proof of that was in the 2012 election. The Republican nominee, Mitt Romney, ran against President Obama for cutting Medicare. So they ran in the opposite direction from what they say they now want. Bob Corker, the senator from Tennessee, who's a conservative, who is serious about this issue, has proposed a comprehensive program for curbing spending on Medicare that fellow Republicans are running away from. So there's a bit of a Keystone Cops element to this. And as Laurie said, in theory, Republicans have a tremendous amount of leverage because congressional action appears to be required to raise the debt limit, without which we would trigger a traumatic loss of confidence in the United States, which would be very damaging to the economy. But that's only in theory if the president is serious in saying we're not negotiating with hostage takers. So that would, if they stick to that, that would suggest that the hostage taking has no value whatsoever, and they would dare Republicans, who polls show Americans blame more than Democrats, to pull the trigger, and then we're all going to have a terrifying couple of months while we figure out if that will happen and what the consequences are for everybody.
John, if at the end of the day today, and as we go to the air, the House is not voted, but as if the House does not vote today, what does that signal to you?
If the House doesn't vote today, it could signal one of two things. One, their members are not prepared to accept this deal, which would be mystifying because it's pretty good from their point of view. Or the second thing is simply as a matter of, late arriving sanity, they would say, let's have one day, to celebrate the new year and come do it tomorrow. Practically speaking, there's no difference whatsoever between enacting this legislation today or tomorrow. But if, in fact, they can't pass it, if the conservatives in their caucus say we're going to have to amend this and send it back to the Senate, then that suggests the whole thing's going to fall apart. We go over the cliff, which would actually be better news for all the people who say they're concerned about budget deficits, but not necessarily good news for economic growth in 2013.
Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst, weigh in here. If the House does not act today, what's that say to you?
Oh, I just think – I'm sorry?
No, go ahead, Jack Beatty.
I think John laid it out very well. I mean, it would say that this is a sort of runaway caucus because, of course, any bill that gets 89 votes in the United States Senate, I mean, that is it provides a kind of political cover for people in the House to vote for it. So I expect that now the issue is, are there 30 Republicans? Are there 25? I don't know what the number is, somewhere in there, who would vote with nearly all the Democrats to put this over? Would Speaker Boehner be willing to do that? Is the Speaker willing to have that vote come before he is officially elected Speaker, which will happen on Thursday? These are the imponderables. I don't know. You know, in talking about this debt ceiling fight, this is a potential constitutional crisis, heavy, it seems to me, with even impeachment overtones. I mean, the president cannot let the debt, the credit of the United States be impugned. And Bill Clinton has said he can use the 14th Amendment to simply raise the debt ceiling himself. If he does that, it's almost inconceivable that the House wouldn't take some very strong action, perhaps even including articles of impeachment.
As Washington circles around a solution, we go out at this moment with some music that reflects the moment. Billy Preston's 1973 hit, Will It Go Round in Circles? This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're reporting this hour from the other side of the fiscal cliff. Yes, technically, we went over it, but the nation is still hanging on with its fingernails, waiting for the House to vote on the package struck late last night by the Senate. And as we go to the air, no House vote yet. Right now, let's go to the phones. Chester is calling On Point from Frankfort, Kentucky. Chester, weigh in here.
Hi, Bob. Hey, it amazes me that the people that we send to Washington, D.C. cannot even work for we the people.
What do you mean by that, Chester?
I mean, it's like, well, I'm from Kentucky. Mitch McConnell's from Kentucky. And he won't even work for the Commonwealth of Kentucky. I mean, what I mean is, like, they get up there and argue, and they cannot agree on, like, if you was to take a beagle hound up there, they would know if it was a dog or what. I guarantee you, you could walk out, and some of them say it was a dog, some of them say it was a cat. They wouldn't be able to agree on nothing.
So if Mitch McConnell was standing in front of you right now, what would you tell him?
I would tell him to do his job. You know, go to work. Work for us, the people of the Commonwealth.
Chester, thanks a lot. Jack Beatty, part of the problem here is that a lot of these congresspeople, the men and women in both the House and the Senate, come from districts that are just enormously safe for them. They face no serious challengers most of the time, and they don't necessarily need to worry about re-election unless on the Republican side they're too far to the center to appease the far right.
That's absolutely right. I saw one statistic that 219 GOP House members were elected or reelected from districts carried by Mr. Romney. And it takes 218 votes to pass things in the House. So right there is an example. And the percentage of people who are returned by landslide proportions in these districts, Nate Silver gave an estimate of that recently. It was dramatic. So, yes, that's a kind of the redistricting that happened with the 2000 after the 2010 elections. Really, it's looming more and more as a huge event in American politics because of the way it has sown these incumbents into districts that are tailored for them.
John Harwood, more immediately, there are some who say that Speaker Boehner was reluctant to push hard on the fiscal cliff issues because he didn't want to jeopardize his hope for re-election by colleagues as Speaker. Do you think that in the middle of all this, he'll win the speakership again?
I do. And I think the concern about the speakership is part of it. But why would he be concerned about the speakership? That would be because the center of gravity of the Republican caucus would go against him. And so, you know, leading the caucus to do what he wants and preserving his speakership are sort of the same thing. It's a very difficult situation. And on the issue of the districts, it's not so much the insulation from general election competition is part of it, but the real heart of the matter is that when we talk about these districts, we're talking about echo chambers where the ideological inclinations of the member are constantly reinforced. And with the modern Republican Party, it is more ideologically pure by a lot than Democrats. And that makes the Republican Party more inflexible and less susceptible to compromise. If you look at the makeup of the people who voted for Mitt Romney in the election, 60% of them are people who call themselves conservatives, 60%. Only 40% of the people who voted for Obama call themselves liberal. So the Democratic Party is leavened with a lot more moderate members, people in the center. That makes them more prone to compromise because they're not as ideologically fierce. Republicans are, and that's one of the reasons we're in this mess.
Will the new Congress be any different from the outgoing one? Will there be a fresh dynamic in Washington, or more of the same?
It won't be a fresh dynamic. It will be a slightly more Democratic House and Senate. Democrats gained a few seats in the Senate. They gained a few seats in the House. That doesn't change the fundamental nature of the dynamic that we're talking about, because the Republicans who make up their caucus and the Democrats who make up the new caucuses in the new Congress are fundamentally the same. They have the same contours and the same characters.
Jack, some say that winning the speakership again will make it easier for Boehner to push a deal on the sequester budget cuts and maybe a deal on raising the debt ceiling. Do you think that's true, or won't he still face the same GOP deal opponents that he faces now?
Oh, I think there's unquestionably. I mean, he will. I don't see that that will affect the debt ceiling at all. And, you know, I'm just struck with the way Republicans are talking about that debt ceiling. I watched a speech that Lindsey Graham gave the other day, and he's you know, anyone who sees him on TV can see that he's a basically reasonable conservative. He always has sound-sounding things to say. And, boy, he was just talking about going to war over the debt ceiling. I mean, it was just, boy, you're not going to get my vote unless you cut, an, you know, whatever we raise the debt by, we've got to make cuts equivalent to it. Well, this is really a huge deal that's going to happen, and the president, I think, feels that he's trying to vindicate the office, that if he allows the Republicans to take the debt ceiling hostage, to take the country hostage again over this, the presidency will be shadowed. I mean, that will simply mean, on the other hand, the money bill, you know, the purse is in the Congress's hand. So it's a constitutional face-off.
Let's hear from another caller. Darren is on the line from Owensboro, Kentucky. Hi, Darren.
Hi. My comment is that the House last time, they couldn't even get a bill to the floor for raising taxes on those making $1 million. And then the Senate, they passed a bill raising taxes for $400,000. So I'm skeptical that the House is going to take this up and pass it, because basically it was a win for the Democrats and the Republicans virtually get nothing out of this. So I don't see them passing that bill.
John Harwood, you think that's correct?
I think the House Republican caucus is likely to vote in a majority against the bill, but I think the Speaker is likely to put it on the floor and let it pass with Democratic votes. We'll see. You know, there's some drama and some uncertainty surrounding what happens at the Republican caucus, and we'll see how ferocious the opposition from the right is. There are already, you know, rumblings from the Heritage Foundation and some of the groups on the right. But given the stakes, given the fact that Mitch McConnell went so far out on a limb to negotiate a deal that ended up getting 89 votes in the Senate, I think the likelihood is that the Speaker would say, I promise to let the House act on this legislation. I'm going to let the House act on it. And that a bipartisan majority with more Democrats than Republicans would pass it.
From the outside, John Harwood, it certainly seems like that, at least in the House, party discipline, you know, squashing down opposition within your own party is a thing of the past by speakers and by leadership. Do you think that's true?
No. As the parties have gotten more homogenous ideologically, you see a much greater incidence of party line voting on every bill. The parties are, Republicans are almost uniformly a conservative party, Democrats are left of center. It is true, though, that for the reason that Jack was outlining, that members face potential challenges from the right, that the party defection tends to be from the ideological heart of the party. So in certain circumstances, that comes to the fore and creates problems, but those circumstances are pretty rare.
Jack Beatty, former Vermont governor and presidential candidate Howard Dean, says he thinks that Speaker Boehner isn't tough enough. Do you agree or disagree with that?
Well, 2 weeks ago, he disciplined, I think, three members who had earlier in the Congress taken positions at variance with the leadership. I think that's significant. He also seems to have healed, if there was a rift, he seems to have healed a rift with Eric Cantor, the majority leader. They're standing together on pretty much everything now. He's only as strong as the caucus, and And the pressures on that caucus, which we've been talking about, he has to bend to those. The days when a speaker could, you know, simply have his will with the Congress are gone. And even those days, you know, were often just sort of legend. I mean, when you really looked at it, speakers didn't have there were rebellions against speakers all the time.
Let's talk to another On Point listener. John is calling from Mason City, Iowa. Hi, John.
Hi, Bob. My comment is I'm just so sick and tired of the gutlessness of the Congress that they only act self-serving to ensure they get reelected rather than doing what's right. And I think this suggests that it's time for term limits. I mean, I think maybe we should change the Constitution, say Congress gets 4 years or 6 years, and then that's it. They don't have to worry about reelection. Then they can do the right thing because reelection is no longer an option.
John Harwood, what do you see as possible for trying to get members of Congress to understand that there is a public out there like that caller, just disgusted by what's going on, so that they actually deal with issues in a timely manner?
I don't know about the timeliness. You know, it's inherent in human nature, and that tendency is exaggerated in politics to put off things until the last minute. I do think that an advance for clarifying the choices is things like the budget that Paul Ryan, the Republican vice presidential nominee, put out, which clarified, not completely, it was silent on Social Security, but in more detail than most Republicans have been willing to do, what his vision is for controlling entitlement expenditures. And the reason that's an advance is that the more those kinds of ideas get put on the table, it clarifies the choices for ordinary Americans so that they can say, okay, do we want to raise taxes to pay for my mother's Medicare benefits or not? Because as long as we're in the realm of very vague cut spending, you know, the American people, if you look at polling data, have a fairly distorted understanding of exactly what federal money is spent on. So that if you told people, well, if you just cut foreign aid and welfare payments to people who are cheating the government, you know, we could balance the budget. Well, that's not true. The money that makes us insolvent in the long run has to do with health care costs and entitlement programs. And the more people understand the trade-offs, the closer we'll get to a resolution of these big questions.
So you're saying that you think the American people need to be made to feel as if they have more at stake?
Well, they need to understand the choices, because fundamentally we have a problem of democracy, which is that people want things from the government and they don't want to pay very much. And that's the core of it. And Republicans represent the people who don't want to pay very much, and Democrats tend to represent the people who want things from government. And the more you can make the rubber hit the road and have people understand exactly what they're buying with additional tax revenue, then they can, through their representatives, make decisions. But the fuzzier it is, the vaguer it is, the more general it is, the harder it is to make the system choose.
Another caller. Let's take another caller. Aaron is on the line from Omaha, Nebraska. Hi, Aaron. You're on Point.
Hi, Bob. My problem is what I see as a false equivalence that's being portrayed in the media, and not on this program necessarily, and certainly not today, but on other news outlets. It's as if the Republicans say one thing, the Democrats say another. See, they're equal. See, we've given equal time to both parties, and therefore, you know, we've been fair. The difference is, however, as explained already on your show, is that really the intransigence in the Republican Party has been the problem with finding a compromise up till now, not in the Democrat side. I feel like the conservative districts are more pure, the liberal districts are less pure ideologically, and it really has been the Republican Party that has stalled this up till now, and I'm sick and tired of the media treating them like they're equal partners in this.
So what would you have us do?
I would ask the media to actually look deeper into the issues, like your guest was just saying a minute ago, of give us more details, more information, not necessarily what the Republicans and Democrats say, but the numbers behind what's going on in Washington so that we can understand and put pressure on our representatives.
John Harwood, this is your bailiwick here. I imagine you agree with Aaron.
Yes, it's not they're not equivalent. They're not the same. Republicans are, for the reasons that we mentioned earlier, of the ideological composition of their party, more intransigent on some of these issues. And the challenge for Democrats, and, you know, President Obama looked to the election as his opportunity to make a big public argument on a large stage to try to clarify the choices and see if he had the upper hand. He did have the upper hand. But as Jack was pointing out, because of the nature of some of these districts and the ideological purity of the people representing them, it is hard to get those people to move. They're not impervious to political pain, but they're pretty well insulated from it.
So then, are you worried we're going to get four more years of political brinksmanship, at least in terms of how Congress deals with fiscal issues?
Yes, I think we're certain to get it. But what will potentially change it is the more punishment a political party with a losing hand takes, the more inclined they are to change the party. Democrats went through a 20-year period between 68 and 88 where they were uncompetitive, generally speaking, except in unusual circumstances, in national elections. Republicans have lost the popular vote in 5 out of 6 presidential elections. At some point, a lot of these Republicans in the House who want to be senators, who want to be president maybe, are going to recognize that they are playing a losing hand and they need to get new cards.
John Harwood of CNBC, thank you very much. Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, thank you. Continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.